Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It was the best of times. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
She'll fight on the beaches.
Away, man. These are the things that made England.
She'll fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello and welcome to The Things That Made England. I'm Roy Field Brown, and with me I have my sometimes mucker.
David Crowther, I'm here mucking.
Who does a rather good podcast when he's not messing around doing this, called The History of England.
That's so
true. David, anybody that's a fan with my podcasting output knows that I'm somewhat left of centre.
Yes, I've spotted that too.
So it's through gritted teeth that I have to nominate The Sun newspaper as one of the things that's made England in the last 50 years.
Well, that's
years,
a bit of a nightmare, isn't it? Presumably you hate The Sun.
Hate would be a strong word, but okay. I have a grudging respect for some elements of what The Sun has managed to do. And I would say that The Sun, which is a tabloid newspaper, which is published in, of course, the United Kingdom, really is the pulse of England. It feels much more English than it does British, because the Scots don't go so much in for The Sun, and neither do the Northern Irish. And actually,
you have read Scottish newspapers, though, have you?
I have.
Right.
I have.
Yeah.
I have.
Are
once or
quite
twice.
Sun-like, aren't they?
Well, there is the Scottish version called the Scottish Sun. There is. But just to underline this, so there is an edition, a regional edition printed in Scotland, one in Northern Ireland, and actually one in the Republic of Ireland. But The Sun is English. And actually, there isn't a Welsh edition.
Too nice in Wales.
Well, we could get onto a rather long and convoluted discussion about Welsh identity. But, you know, there's a reason why, I would say, that, you know, the Welsh have an assembly, but the Scots have a parliament.
I was just going to say that the Welsh are too nice to like the Sun newspaper. You've taken it places, you know, I wouldn't go without sharp implement close to me.
Why is Kylie called Bruiser? Why did Craig wear a dress? Alan's battle to marry his Miss Australia in The Sun reveals the bizarre secrets of the neighbor stars.
You've seen us all on television. Now read about our private lives.
In The Sun, plus free beer. The Sun's giving away 25,000 homebrew kits absolutely free. That's a million pints. In The Sun this week. And stand by for Lotto 2. £152,000 to win. The biggest Lotto Popo ever. Only in The Sun tomorrow.
Starting inside Monday's Sun, don't miss your free Big Bucks Bingo scratch card. There are loads of cash prizes. A top prize of £50,000. Or free sessions at Gala Bingo. Everyone's a winner. Super smashing great. Scratch and match the numbers every day. Don't miss your free Big Bucks Bingo scratch card only inside Monday's Sun. We love it.
That nice little woman down your street. Underneath it all, she's one of the huntresses. This week, The Sun looks at a new breed of woman who no longer waits to be asked. Young and old, single and married, they all hunt their men and bring them back alive. Meet the huntresses in The Sun. Learn how to talk to your body to make it beautiful in The Sun.
And let them truckers roll.
Find out what it's like in the world of the truck driver. Discover the secrets of their private code, learn their slang, and meet their girls. in Go Trucker Go. All in your super 5p Sun this week.
So the Sun newspaper started life in 1964. As a broadsheet, so it was a big old newspaper.
Is that right?
It was the successor to the Daily Herald. It only became a tabloid in 1969 after it was purchased by News Group Newspapers, a subsidiary of News Corp. So the Sun previously had the largest circulation of any daily newspaper in the UK. And it held that title for approximately 30 years until earlier on this year, when it was knocked off its perch by the Metro. And even now, it still has an average daily circulation of 1.4 million copies sold throughout the United Kingdom. Now, throughout
the Guardian?
It's the biggest sold newspaper. So it is bigger than the Guardian.
Sorry, I was being funny. Do the Guardian still sell any newspapers?
I thought you were being facetious. I said the Guardian is a trust, isn't it? And I forget who actually owns the trust, and they lose money every year.
Well, I'm not surprised. There's probably two people who read it now. One of them's Luke, and the other's you.
Well, I read it online extensively.
Right.
And
I'll stop being rude about the Grawny-ad now. Keep going.
Please do. So what the Sun has done is to be involved in lots of controversies during its 50-odd years history as a tabloid. And one of the controversies we're going to talk about today is the 1989 Hillsborough Football Stadium disaster, which has been significant, except to them, considering that heinous headline that they wrote in the aftermath of that tragedy. But in 1964, David, the Sun newspaper was born. Is published as a replacement for the Mirror Group's Daily Herald, which had been losing readers and revenue for years. And they said, you know what, we're going to give it a rebrand. It promised to follow a radical and independent agenda. And like its predecessor, it had strong parties to the Labour Party. It starts off being this really working class paper. The Mirror Group newspapers took ownership of the Herald in 1961. By 1969, the Sun, the broadsheet Sun, was losing £2 million a year, which is a lot of money now, let alone in 1969, and had a circulation of 800,000. So people were reading it, but it was seen as being worthy, boring, leftish, and, you know, and a populist broadsheet. But it was just worthy. It was boring. Rupert Murdoch came in and bought it, and the year before, he'd bought a title called The News of the World, which was a populist Sunday tabloid newspaper, which he'd bought.
Well, The News of the World makes the Sun a quality, doesn't it?
Which he bought for £800,000.
Right.
The Daily Herald had been printed up in Manchester up until that point. After Murdoch buys it, he basically moves the printing of it down to the Fleet Street area in London, which is the home of the UK press. The Sun recruits 125 reporters immediately when it becomes a tabloid, and it ran as a sister paper to the News of the World, which is very important because it kind of takes on the tone of the News of the World. And the first headline back in November the 17th of 1969 is Horse Dope Sensation, and that really sets the tone for the newspaper for the next 50-odd years. It's attention grabbing headlines.
What was the headline again?
Horse Dope Sensation. And the paper copied its circulation rival, the Daily Mirror, in several ways. It became the same size, it was a tabloid. And tabloid in the UK does physically mean the size, but also it's a tone of the newspaper. So it's very attention grabbing.
Indeed. Yeah, although the Times, of course, now is a tabloid, isn't it?
Tabloid in size.
Yeah.
Tabloid in size.
Not in spirit.
But as well as being the same size as the Daily Mirror, because that was the high-selling newspaper at the time, it copied its masthead in terms of being read with right writing. That's very deliberate. So it was a bit of a Mirror clone. And remember, it came out of the Mirror's stable some 6 years beforehand. But one of the totems of this newspaper was to be page three, where a topless model appeared with nothing but a smile, David. I'm sure...
Is that right?
Teenage David Crowther would have a cheeky peek at page three.
It's pitiful,
am I wrong?
When you go and have my hair done, when you go and get a haircut, there are always Daily Mail sitting around. The question was, at the age of 12 or whatever it was, whether you dared sneak at page three.
You mean there was a Sun?
There was a sun, right. Yes, because there was no sun at our home. I'm sorry to tell you that.
Well, you know, there was
Dad,
no
Mum
sun
and Dad didn't read the sun.
Neither did my parents. Always been mirror people. But Stephanie Raine was the first woman who appeared topless on page 3 in 1970 in The Sun. And she was tagged as the birthday suit girl to mark that anniversary of the relaunch of the paper. This is how influential page 3 became as a part of English life. Sam Fox, I forget how many times she appeared on page 3, and Linda Lusardi were two page 3 girls that went on to become celebrities in their own right in the next two decades. Sam Fox had a TV career, became a pop star. Linda Lusardi was always on game shows and panel shows, etc.
I never knew who Linda Lusardi was. I might actually look her up as we speak.
Oh, lovely looking woman with dark brown hair, big smile, wavy hair. You'll know as soon as you see a picture while you Google her. The page 3 model became a regular fixture with increasingly risque poses. Both feminists and cultural conservatives saw it as pornographic and misogynistic. You found page 3 girls' photos pinned up in mechanics' garages the length and breadth of the country. Page 3, whether you loved it or loathed it, it was a peculiarly English institution. Politically, The Sun in the early Murdoch years was nominally supported Labour. So it remained true to its working class roots. It advocated a vote for the Labour Party led by Harold Wilson in the 1970 election with the headline, Why It Must Be Labour. But by February 1974, it was calling for a vote for the Conservative Party led by Edward Heath. This was a totemic and seismic shift in allegiance that was to last for some 22 years.
Yeah, I must admit, I've always thought of it as right-wing. I didn't realise it started off as left-wing.
In the 1975 referendum on Britain continuing membership of the European Economic Community, it advocated a vote to stay in the common market, though by the late 1980s, it had become extremely Eurosceptic. And just to back up what you said before with the last comment about it starting off as being a Labour-supporting newspaper, it was pro-Europe. And you can't imagine that now.
No.
This newspaper has so become synonymous with right-wing politics in the United Kingdom. And dare I say, with English nationalism and English politics, that it kind of really belies its roots. And when you go back and research it, you're like, eh? They said what initially? Anyway, The Sun overtook Daily Mirror's circulation in 1978 to become the largest selling newspaper in the UK. The Sun was extremely profitable, and this enabled Rupert Murdoch to expand his operations to the United States in 1973. So, Fox News and all of that over here, we've got The Sun to thank for, David.
Well, is that right?
Yeah.
The Fox News is a result of The Sun.
Rupert Murdoch first expanded his operations into the United States from 1973. That's what gives him a toehold, because The Sun is just so profitable. He completely turned it around in terms of it being this loss-making entity, and within 4 years, it's making money hand over fist.
Well, good Lord. I mean, I haven't heard any good things about Fox News. Don't know much about it, to be honest, but everything I've read about it...
There's nothing much to be said about it. Anyway, moving swiftly on, Thatcher years. And this is kind of like peak Sun, really, the Thatcher years. In 1979, the newspaper endorsed Margaret Thatcher in that year's general election with the headline, Vote Tory This Time. The paper was to become her most vocal of supporters in the media during her tenure in power. This was to set the tone for the 1980s in England politically and economically. Always with an eye on marketing, it introduced Bingo in 1981 and dropped by 2p its cover price. And also 1981 is significant because it unveiled its new editor, Kelvin McKenzie, who said that the paper would become more outrageous, opinionated and irreverent than ever anything else that had been produced in England.
Get into The Sun and shape up for spring with Olympic athlete Bruce Tallow in Keep Fit Fever in The Sun.
Mr. Churchill, you're drunk.
Mrs. Braddock, you're ugly.
But in the morning, I shall be sober.
Don't miss the all-time great insults in The Sun. There's a riot of fabulous new girls on page 3. Meet Stephanie, Tina, Boney and Kim.
What's Britain's best buy? The Sun.
And get The Sun for Marlon Brando. There's an amazing peep into the island hideaway of this sulky superstar. And Mary Whitehouse, Saint or Censor, prepare for big surprises as she talks to The Sun. Super sexy Speed Ace Barry Sheen.
I'll tell you how to get more out of your bike in The Sun.
Plus, win a Cortina, win lunch in a nuclear sub at the bottom of the sea, win fabulous health farm holidays, and keep fit fans, 50 tracksuits must be won, plus all kinds of training gear. All in your brighter, bouncier Sun this week.
The Falklands War in 1982 saw The Sun to be an ardent supporter of that conflict, with its coverage capturing the zeitgeist. It was jingoistic and xenophobic, and ultimately triumphalist. The front page of The Sun, which was the 4th of May following the torpedoing of the General Belgrano, was quite simply, gotcha. It's one of the most memorable English newspaper headlines of all time. The Sun claimed to have sponsored a British missile that was used in the conflict, with the immortal headline, "Stick this up your yunta."
Gosh, I do remember that actually, yeah, I must admit. Because I remember the gotcha, I remember the "stick this up your yunta."
That is the thing about The Sun. They had brilliantly simple headlines. They were utterly puntastic, but they were good, which belied a deep intelligence and a great way of writing, which you could kind of ignore or not even see when reading some of the content actually of the paper.
Well, I mean, now, I think, absolutely hated The Sun, as I hated most media, but the actually, when you read it, they are very good copywriters. When you can read, you can get most of your article from the first paragraph. They have a structure. And you can read the story from their subheads. So next time you pick up The Sun, you know, to look at the, obviously, the page 3. Is the page 3 still there?
It's not.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. When you pick up your Sun next time, pick a story, one of the main items, and just read the subheads. The subheads will tell you what's in the paragraph below it. And the subheads together will tell you the story. It is a very structured writing style.
Mm-hmm. And a writing style that by 1982 was being mocked as such. Private Eye lampooned the paper's kind of jingoistic coverage of the Falklands War, most memorably with a mock Sun headline that said, "Kill an Argy, win a Metro," to which... And a Metro was an old car at the time, which you could buy. To which Kelvin McKenzie jokingly said, "Why didn't we think of that?"
They were utterly shameless, weren't they? I mean, there was almost no point getting upset with them, much as I hated it. Because, you know, every time you reacted to it, it's like social media now, actually. You know, whatever bullshit you see on Twitter, there's absolutely no point arguing with it. The only thing to do is to ignore it. The only thing that will have any impact on things like The Sun is not to buy it.
Well, The Sun starts off being this Labour-supporting newspaper. Throughout the 1980s, it was ruthlessly anti-Labour. During the election of 1983, The Sun ran a front page featuring an unflattering photograph of the then Labour leader, Michael Foot, then aged almost 70, alongside the headline, "Do you really want this old fool to run Britain?" And it made frequent scathing attacks on what the paper called the loony left element within the Labour Party. During the miners' strike of 1984-85, the paper supported the police and the Thatcher government against the striking NUM miners, and in particular had venom for its then leader and president, Arthur Scargill. The paper ran a front page with the headline "Mine Führer" and a photograph of Scargill with his hand in the air as if giving a Nazi salute.
Well, it is an outrage, isn't it?
One of the incredible things about that whole dispute was that Arthur Scargill kept on saying there is a dossier to close down the mining industry. And the government at the time said, absolutely not, absolutely not. And he was absolutely right. Everything he said came to pass and actually was government policy to close down the whole mining industry. And he said, we're going to have towns bereft of industry. That's the reason why we're fighting for this. And he said, there is still viability within coal.
Can I just note that you've segued into our Margaret Thatcher episode?
These two do go hand in hand. They do go hand in hand because, as I said about 5-10 minutes ago, that the Sun newspaper was Margaret Thatcher's most vociferous well of support throughout the whole 1980s. It never wavered from the side of Thatcher and Thatcherism.
The extraordinary thing, of course, is how many right-wing papers we have.
Well, that's something which I'm going to go to come on to mention later. And right-wing commentators always say that the UK has a balanced press in terms of left and right, and it's nothing like
Absolutely not true. Loads of its newspapers.
No. And there's statistical evidence, which I'll bring up later. But the 1980s, as well as the newspaper being an ardent supporter of Thatch, the paper had an affinity with ridiculous celebrity storylines. And one of the famous headlines is, "Freddie Starr ate my hamster."
Yes. Was that The Sun?
It's The Sun.
I always thought that was The Screws of the World.
No. That is The Sun.
Freddie Starr ate my hamster.
Now, Freddie Starr was a somewhat D-list.
Did Freddie Starr actually eat the hamster?
No.
Didn't he? I wouldn't put it past Freddie, actually.
Well, this is the thing. If anybody's going to eat an hamster, it's going to be Ozzy Osbourne or Freddie Starr. It's going to be one or the other. But this was a headline on the 13th of March in 1986. The paper's reputation for running sensationalistic stories with questionable veracity, you know, it was kind of cemented in English minds by then. The story was invented by PR man Max Clifford. Starr had to be persuaded that the apparent revelation would not damage his career. The attention actually helped to revive his career, though. And Starr wrote some 20 years afterwards that the incident was a complete fabrication. "I've never eaten or even nibbled a live hamster, gerbil, guinea pig, mouse, shrew."
Nobody's going to believe that. I mean, who hasn't nibbled a hamster?
But it's just wonderful. This quote is just so wonderful, the way he just goes through all these small rodents. So let's just do this again. "I have never, ever eaten or even nibbled a live hamster, gerbil, guinea pig, mouse, shrew, vole, or any other small mammal. The only thing he's missing is a rat. So maybe Freddie Starr ate my rat. Yeah. As I said, like the 1980s, there's this kind of symbiotic relationship between celebrity news and the Sun newspaper. And in lots of ways, it's a precursor to what the Daily Mail does now. But fueled by then-editor Kelvin McKenzie's preoccupation with celebrity stories, the Sun kind of insinuated and spread rumours about the sexual orientation of famous people. The Sun ran a series of false stories about the pop musician Elton John. Elton John received a $1 million out-of-court settlement because of these lies, which at that point was the largest damages ever paid in British history. And the paper was weirdly anti-gay in the 1980s, which is something we'll come back to just as we kind of wrap this up. It ran articles about the Poops of Pop, US gay blood plague killing 3 in Britain, and in 1989 even ran a headline that straight sex cannot give you AIDS. In 1990, the Press Council adjudicated against The Sun and columnist Gary Bushell for the use of the derogatory term about gays. This is all like the 1980s. It hates gay people, it's pro-Thatcher, and it's extremely jingoistic. The Hillsborough football stadium disaster in Sheffield in April 1989 was to prove a long-running PR and sales disaster for the newspaper that still lingers on to this day. The paper later admitted that it was the most terrible blunder in its history. So in 1989, on that fateful day on the 15th of April, some 96 people died as the result of injuries caused by police negligence whilst they were trying to watch a football match. The next day, under the headline "The Truth," the paper printed allegations provided to them, they said, by the police and by some fans. Fans had been seen picking the pockets of the crushed victims, that others had urinated on members of the emergency services as they tried to help people who were dying in the football stadium, and that even some fans had assaulted a police constable whilst he was trying to administer the kiss of life to somebody who was dying on the pitch. The headline, "The Truth," was written by Kelvin McKenzie, the editor.
It's an occasion which has never faded, hasn't it? You know, it's probably never will, actually. Probably, well, I don't know, never is a big word, but it was such an horrendous thing.
When I was doing my research on the history of the Sun, you couldn't help but keep coming back to this incident, because it wasn't just the headline. It was the fact that for years, even when the truth emerged that this was police lies and cover-up, that Kelvin McKenzie still believed, say stridently, that no, those Liverpool fans at that tragedy were acting in the most heinous way. And what made it worse for the inhabitants of Liverpool and for Liverpool fans, this headline came out before they can even bury their dead. So that front page headline caused outrage in Liverpool, where people knew what the truth was because they were physically there. And the paper lost 3/4 of its estimated 55,000 daily sales in Merseyside, which is the county where Liverpool is, immediately. And some 30 years later, it's never recovered. Only some 12,000 newspapers are sold in Merseyside to this day. And Liverpoolians won't even take up the paper for free. And quite often what you saw in 1989 were people either burning copies of The Sun or just tearing it up. And people in Liverpool refer to the newspaper as the scum.
Yeah, I mean, the shame in a way, I mean, that was just an appalling occasion. It's a shame that it took that for us to realise just what a horrid thing it is. You know, it's in the end, you get the kind of get the press you deserve. And I suppose people took the attitude that The Sun wasn't really a newspaper, and it's a bit like the News of the World in that way, or the Sunday Sport. That it wasn't a newspaper, really. You didn't read it for the news. You read it for a bunch of outrageous articles. But nonetheless, you know, just selling, you know, what we call fake news these days.
Well, if we put aside specifically this headline and the accompanying news story, what The Sun, what Kelvin McKenzie would say they wanted to do is to put fun into the news. It made everything entertaining. Yeah. That's what it did. You know, as opposed to the Daily Mirror, which had John Pilger as a reporter still on its books at the time, that did investigative journalism to uncover social injustice at home and abroad. The Sun was always about fun. That's fundamentally it. Yeah. Though, with some great journalists. But this is really significant because the Sun newspaper lost many millions of pounds in revenue and sales from the boycott on Merseyside. Post cost News International, and this is in 1989 terms, Dave, and this number is staggering. Approximately £15 million per month has been lost because of that boycott in Merseyside. It's one of the longest and most successful boycotts the UK has ever seen. The boycott showed consumer power, strengthened a city, and aided its battle for truth and justice. And think about that. For some 30 years, they've lost £15 million a month because of it.
Amazing,
it's utterly staggering, utterly staggering. And what made this worse for the people of Merseyside was Kelvin McKenzie, as I said before, being resolute in defending that headline. There was a good reason that the people of Liverpool fought this and said, no, this did not happen, because there was they had to battle for an inquiry. And the government said, no, no, no. This went on for some 20-odd years before there was an independent Hillsborough panel that reported in the September of 2012 that there was a verdict of unlawful killing, and then actually the South Yorkshire Police had covered up their own negligence, that they had kept the doors open and allowed fans to come in continuously, then crushing the fans right at the front. This was all a police cover-up.
So at what point did The Sun apologise? They did eventually apologise, didn't they? Was that after the inquiry had...
Well, I discovered that quite soon afterwards, Kelvin McKenzie actually did call then-Liverpool manager Kenny Dalglish and said, Kenny, what can we do to correct this situation? Within a year or so, after the tragedy, when they were still saying in the paper that the people of Liverpool had urinated on the emergency services. It's just outrageous things to say. Kelvin McKenzie rang Kenny Dalglish, in which Dalglish responded, "You know that big headline, the truth. All you have to do is put 'we lied' in the same size, then you might be all right." To which McKenzie said to Dalglish that he couldn't. Dalglish replied, "I can't help you then." Now, just to wrap this up, after the report in 2012, The Sun apologised on its front page under the headline, "The Real Truth." And they said, "It's a version of events that 23 years ago, The Sun went along with. And for that, we're deeply ashamed and profoundly sorry. We've cooperated fully with the Hillsborough Independent Panel. We will reflect on our deep sense of shame." And again, this wasn't just a headline, but this went to go and bolster the criminal behaviour of the police in trying to cover up their own negligence. And that's in part why people were so angry. It wasn't just the original headline. It was the fact that this was the official line of, in effect, the government through the Sun newspaper, which held up an independent inquiry for some three decades. Anyway, let's just quickly start to wound this up. By the 1990s, the Sun is completely in bed with the Tory party. One of their famous headlines is, "It's the Sun what won it," which was the front page of the Sun in April 1992, of the Conservatives won the 1992 election. That headline is regularly mentioned in debates about the media influence in British politics. Incredibly, incredibly kind of like totemic headline, that "It's the Sun what won it."
And as an observer, obviously circulations have fallen massively since then. Well, papers still as influential as they were?
Between 1994 and 1996, the Sun's circulation peaked its highest average sale in the week ending July 16, 1994, was, check this out, 4.3 million.
Yeah.
You know, it sold a lot of newspapers. By 1997, Labour had a new leader, Tony Blair, and he had a new approach to the right-wing Sun: appeasement, not confrontation. Blair immediately went on a charm offensive to make peace with the proprietor, Rupert Murdoch. At that point, Labour had the support of, to go back to your point before, 11% of the national newspaper market, in contrast to the Tories' 57%. So when the Sun newspaper came out in support of the Labour Party in March 1997, this was a big deal. And they did that some 6 weeks before the general election victory, which saw the new Labour leader, Tony Blair, become the Prime Minister with a large parliamentary majority. The paper's overt anti-gay stance also came to an end round about that time. There was changing social mores. And this was kind of highlighted when Cabinet Minister Peter Mandelson was outed by Matthew Paris, who was formerly a Sun columnist, on BBC TV's Newsnight in November 1998. Misjudging the public response, the Sun's then editor, David Yelland, wrote a front page editorial opining whether Britain was governed by a gay mafia. 3 days later, the paper apologised in another editorial, saying the Sun would never again reveal a person's sexuality unless it could be defended on the grounds of overwhelming public interest. By the 2000s, the Sun is openly antagonistic towards other European nations. Well, it had been for quite some time before, particularly the French and the Germans, and then the new Eastern European migrants to England. During the 1980s and 90s, the French and the Germans had routinely been described in copy and headlines as frogs, krauts, or even the Hun.
That whole language thing has changed a lot, hasn't it? You know, you would never do that now.
Again, it's one of the reasons why I just think that this newspaper, even though I never read it as a kid, you always saw it. And yes, as an eight-year-old boy, you turn over and look at page three and giggle. But it is completely reflective of the last 50 years in so many ways. Its support of Thatcher. It continued to use the language of the Second World War, krauts and Huns. And people thought, some people thought anyway, not everybody, it was all just a bit of fun. But it reflected a time, you know, it felt very loads of money in the 1980s.
Yeah, it's very unapologetic, wasn't it?
Yeah. By 2010, he kind of breaks his pact with the Labour Party and goes back to supporting the Conservatives and wrote articles about broken Britain and controversies around crime and immigration and public service failures, which really go to where we are today. There is no more page three. As of January 2015, the then editor, Dominic Mohan, said that page three was an innocuous British institution, though actually what he did was to quietly shelf it with no fanfare. It's no surprise that The Sun officially endorsed the Leave campaign in the British referendum to remain or to leave the European Union in 2016, considering its kind of jingoistic history and the fact that it called the French frogs in headlines. Its headline, Believe in Britain, so B, then L-E-A-V-E, Believe in Britain, is iconic. Though, significantly, the Scottish Sun and the Northern Ireland version of the Sun did not have that headline, which just goes to show, again, this is an English newspaper. This is an English institution. The Sun has dominated circulation figures for daily newspapers in the United Kingdom since the late 1970s, at times easily outpacing its nearest rivals, the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror. Its sustained decline began in 2004, but that was really in line with print journalism as a whole. From 2012 to 18, it has lost more than a million copies from its daily figures. However, it still remains the largest selling sold newspaper in the UK. David, does The Sun still have the power it once had to claim to be a reflection of English attitudes? No, but it's impossible to sell and tell the story of England since 1969 without reference to it. I give you The Sun newspaper, sir.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I always hated, absolutely detested The Sun. I don't think I've looked at it for, 10 years? I mean, I know almost nothing about it now. Might say something about my life and where it's gone, I don't know. But, you know, I find it impossible to find it a bit of fun because what it talked about was so so vile. So I find, you know, it's one of those things I have a sense of humour failure about. I suppose at best I can, as you say, identify that there's obviously a skill and expertise there. They know how to push buttons. They know how to write copy. They know how to grab attention. But it's the it's a skill employed in support of the devil. Don't know what else to say about it, really. I mean, if we're saying it's not going in the cabinet, it's going in the cabinet over my dead body. Telling you that much right here and there.
But David, right, well, these are the things that made England, warts and all, and I would say that this is definitely something which has made England. And it's interesting that when I was talking about the Falklands War, you said I'm straying into the Margaret Thatcher edition. Which I penned.
I think it was when we got onto Arthur Scargill, actually.
Oh, that's it, true. But there are so many overlaps here. And what this paper has done is to use things which are iconically English. And do you remember I talked about, I think it's my second edition, the second podcast that I did. And I talked about Dunkirk being quintessentially an English phenomenon. And one of the things which I used to illustrate that point was the fact that the Sun newspaper did a headline, "Who do you, EU, think you are kidding Mr. Cameron?" And we all know what it's referring to. This newspaper has used English totems, English icons, English iconography all the way through its history to display, I would say, a very one-note version of England.
Well, I think that's why I wouldn't put it in the cabinet. I mean, it might be designed, despite the fact that it's, as you say, it's got things like the Irish Sun, the Scottish Sun, and all the rest of it. Even leaving that aside, it plays to a still relatively small part of England, even with its circulation at 4 million. The fact that it's done some attention-grabbing headlines, which people have been more outraged at than supportive of, doesn't make it a thing that made England or expressive of England.
But you can't have a publication which for 30 years has been the nation's top selling newspaper and ignore it. It spoke to and still speaks to and for a very vocal English subset.
Yeah, it's we might call a minority of English people, and a even smaller minority of everywhere else it was published. So Ireland, Scotland, doesn't make it a thing that made England.
David,
it's not going in.
When you look at English political history in the last 60 years, you can't report upon it, you can't comment on it without saying things like the 1992 headline, after It's a Somewhat Won It, 2 days later. No, sorry, 2 days before that. So the day of the election, they ran a headline, which was, if Kinnock wins today, will the last person to leave Britain please turn out the lights? These are totally landmark in terms of their political influence when we look back at the history.
Well, hang on a second about that. I mean, the fact that the Sun newspaper has made a specious, unprovable, unproven claim that it's always commented
on when you look back at the 1992 general election. It's a little bit like Nixon and Kennedy in the 1960 debate. Political scientists always say that on radio, Nixon won that debate. On TV, Kennedy won it because Kennedy was good-looking and Nixon was sweating. Whether it was true or not is almost by the by, but it's written into the political narrative of that election. It's like the Britain's Not Working billboard by Saatchi & Saatchi with the long queues of people lining up to do the dole. Whether it actually influenced one vote or not, or pushed the Tories over, you know, over the hill in terms of majority, is almost immaterial. It's just written into our DNA and saying, 1979 election, Britain's not working. The Sun has so encapsulated the mood of the time, and people report on it thus.
I'm going to argue that what you're saying is quite true, that they did some extremely attention-grabbing headlines, some very effective headlines, which will always remain part of that narrative because they prove a point. But they didn't encapsulate the time. People noticed it because they were very striking. What you're making a different claim. You're claiming that it embodied the views and the spirit of a nation, and absolutely did not.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Doing the digging that I've done, people like Roy Greenslade, who's a very respected and a newspaper editor, who I'd even forgotten even worked for The Sun. Because Roy Greenslade, I see this totally respectable. I think he edited The Guardian in the end, Roy Greenslade. But he worked for The Sun. And he says that word. He says zeitgeist. He says The Sun encapsulated, definitely in the 1980s, the zeitgeist. It was the era of loads of money, with Harry Enfield playing that character. It was the era of White Van Man, and it feels like The Sun. And I think it'd be almost churlish to say that it doesn't really. When we think of the 1980s and Thatcher's transformation of the country, it goes hand in hand with The Sun being her propaganda wing. It absolutely does. And as I said first off, I'm a big lefty, but I have to give them credit where credit's due. Right, that they've made an indelible mark on the psyche of the country that I was born into and that I love. And there's some of the headlines were just brilliant, and it's not all about politics. So when George Michael was done for drugs, the headline was Careless Spliffer. When Bin Laden was thrown into a plastic bag, his body was thrown into a plastic bag at sea, the headline was Bin Bagged. Tony Blair, Weapon of Mass Deception. And one which I didn't know this one at all when I was just doing the research. I bumped into this. So Manchester City had an Argentinian footballer called Carlos Tevez who was done. It had to serve 250 hours of community service.
I remember him, yeah.
I presume he was driving his car too fast or something. Yeah, the headline was, "Don't cry for me, RG Cleaner." It's just brilliant. You know, that's brilliant.
I am prepared to accept that they're good copywriters. And that is as far as I'm going to go, though.
Alright. So I like the fact that you're disagreeing with me.
Okay.
However, David, you are wrong.
I wish you were right.
I wish I could agree with you.
Summed up the with at most 4 million circulation represented a nation.
It represented the prevailing political mood of the time, definitely in the 1980s. It backed a right wing regime, backed it to the hilt, and you can't think of the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher et al., without thinking of the Sun newspaper in large part as well. In the 2000s, is it as powerful an organ as it used to be in the 1980s? Absolutely not. And it isn't just down to fall in circulation. The nation has changed. It has changed. But even then, still, they could come out with some iconic headlines and influence British politics. You know, Tony Blair, when he came into power, toadied up to Rupert Murdoch. He did.
Prime Ministers toady up to newspaper editors. I mean, that's kind of what happens. That's one of the... newspaper editors are part of the establishment. Despite what it looks like from the outside, when it comes down to it, these lot talk to each other.
No, absolutely. But it's much more overt in the UK than it appears to be over here in the US. In the US, and also over here, it appears, with the exception of maybe the New York Times and New York Post, papers over here aren't so slavish with their political adherence. They're not. And also, technically speaking, there aren't any national newspapers in the United States because the country's just too big. Yes, the Washington Post is default one and the New York Times. So politicians don't have to run to various newspaper editors and go and get their endorsement in the way that it seems to happen in the UK. Papers... I forget what the newspaper is called in Iowa, before the Democratic nominee or the Republican nominee wins out, the Iowa Sentinel, whatever the heck it's called, will say, okay, we're going to endorse this person or that. It flits from party to party in a way that United Kingdom newspaper endorsement doesn't really. Ours is much more, well, you just know this paper gives you this political line, full stop. So for the Sun to flip from being Labour to Tory in 1974 and then in 1997 to flip to Labour is seismic. That in and of itself is a seismic political /media occurrence. So it's churlish of you, sir, to say that it can't go in the cabinet. But I think we should let our good listeners decide.
I am going to remain churlish.
And as always, they will agree with me.
Actually, they probably will.
They barely ever, but they really should on this one.
But if they do, they'll be just wrong to agree with you. On this one, whatever. Anyway, I agree. We're going to have to call it a draw and, send it over to arbitration.
Okay. Well, it's not a draw at all. We're just going to have them ratify this very obvious statement of fact. But what we should do is go and hear what the listeners said about the Beatles last time out.
Well, obviously, before I go any further, I must say welcome back to David and Royfield after their little hiatus. I had been encouraging them to try to make out that it was all part of a master plan, and that this was a scheduled break between season one and season two of The Things That Made England. But of course, our dear presenters are far too honourable to pull such a dastardly trick. And what a return it was. The Beatles, of course. Some have said that David has a tendency to go for the obvious choices, but there's no denying the numbers. We have got a resounding 89 votes that say yes. We had 13 grumblers who thought they were just a band. 5 who thought that only Queen would stand the test of time. And then 2 votes each for various subcategories of fence-sitting. Speaking of stats, and not to be outdone by Royfield, I too have prepared a spreadsheet to calculate which are our listeners' favourite Beatles songs. I extracted the data from the top five lists that people shared on Facebook, gave some leeway to those who felt the need to include an honourable mention or their wives' favourite song, then did some serious number crunching, and we have a tie. While My Guitar Gently Weeps and Eleanor Rigby appeared on five lists each. There was also a tie for next place between Hey Jude and Let It Be, which had three appearances apiece. But I thought the really interesting stat that came out of this exercise was that the list included 43 songs. I think that it really says something about the Beatles and the quality and quantity of their output that so many of their songs mean so much to so many of us. I particularly enjoyed Wayne's list as he included details about why each song he chose meant something to him. It certainly wasn't all a massive Beatles love-in on our Facebook group. There were some dissenting voices, chief among them, Tim. As a Liverpudlian growing up in the 60s, the Beatles were pretty much unavoidable, and he resented having their music rammed down his ears and was much more of a Stones or the Doors person. Nothing wrong with that. Interestingly, Catherine felt that she noted a tone of distaste from Royfield towards the Fab Four, which Royfield vehemently denied. And to be fair, Catherine, the man has got a spreadsheet, which does show a certain amount of commitment, I would say. Fortunately, JW restored some sanity. Both David and Royfield seem to think that Oh Bloody Bloody Da is some sort of masterpiece, but JW called it out as the tripe it undoubtedly is. The worst. The absolute worst. The only good thing about it is that it's the first song on the White Album, so very easy to skip. My favourite Beatles-related anecdote was from Jacqueline, who went to a Purim spiel at a synagogue with the band playing Beatles songs with a Jewish spin. You should come over to the Facebook and read all about it. But we also had a couple of what Stuart would call proper Barneys. Steve VG, not for the first time in my experience, decided to play Devil's Advocate, but didn't seem to really have his heart in it. Unlike Steeple, who started off by saying that the Beatles were not innovative and took it from there. And all of a sudden, Cliff and the Shadows came out of the woodwork. But the big one was Thomas's proposition that something about the Beatles not being English at all. I can hardly bring myself to repeat it here on air. I'm afraid you're just going to have to get onto the Facebook group to read it in all its absurdity. I warn you, though, it has got 75 replies. Actually, to be fair, it does make for quite a good read that delves into interesting questions round the point about who owns culture. Though towards the end it does descend into a delightful bickering match between Thomas and Ben on some of the finer points of epistemology, whatever that is. My attempt to get my own Barney going, trying to pit Lennon against McCartney, got very short shrift from Peter for being specious. And then everybody seemed to concur that the best between Paul and John was actually George. Rowena and Jacob had a bit of a to and fro about how much influence the Beatles really had when compared to Black Sabbath, the Sex Pistols, or Donny Osmond. Oh, Rowena. You should all be fresh from listening to one of Royfield's more left-field choices of A Thing That Made England. And I hope to see you all in the Facebook group to decide whether it makes it into the cabinet or not.
Well, thank you for that, listeners.
Very good. Well, thank you for dragging me through the mire of, terrible memories of the Sun over the last 50 years. I've managed to forget it. I've managed to put it behind me, Royfield, and you opened all those old wounds.
This is the most strident I've ever heard you on any topic.
I mean, I'm not keen on the British media at the best of times.
You're not even that strident about your own kith and kin, your own family.
Sorry, am I married? Oh, yes, I am. Yeah. We've got a family. Yes, no, absolutely. I'm not keen and on any of them, really. And the Sun's the worst of the bunch, really. Right, it's been a joy.
And just before we go, folks, I'm just going to say this for David, because I know David means to say this.
I cannot do this every week. It becomes wallpaper.
You don't know what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry. Okay. That's a fair point.
Thank you for listening to the Things That Made England.
You're going to ask me to do a
review? I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
But now you've actually just said it. You just said it. So thank you for listening to the Things That Made England. And I tell you what you could do for us, if you've got a couple of minutes, go tell a friend, go tell a family member to listen to it too. And we'll see you all again soon. Bye-bye from me.
Bye, everybody.
You got me completely wrong.
Yeah, one wrong one out of 10.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.